of VOA News. I'm Tommy McNeil. Israel announced Sunday it has withdrawn more soldiers from southern Gaza. Reuters correspondent Freddie Joyner reports.
The move leaves just one brigade, according to a spokesperson for the force on Sunday. They did not give details on reasons for withdrawing soldiers or the numbers involved. Since the start of the year, Israel has been reducing numbers in Gaza to relieve reservists. Ally Washington has been adding pressure to improve the humanitarian situation, especially after last week's killing of several aid workers. Meanwhile, Egypt is preparing to host a new round of talks aimed at reaching a ceasefire and hostage release deal. Both Israel and Hamas said they would attend.
That's Reuters' Freddie Joyner. A U.S.-based aid group is calling for a wider investigation into the Israeli strike that killed seven of its workers. AP correspondent Jackie Quinn.
Celebrity chef and humanitarian Jose Andres was in tears as he spoke about the aid workers who lovingly made sure that displaced Palestinians in Gaza were getting food. And on ABC's This Week with George Stephanopoulos, Andres called for a full investigation into the Israeli military conduct against his group and others.
This is not anymore about the seven men and women of World Central Kitchen that perished on this unfortunate event. This is happening way for too long. It's been 6 months of targeting anything that seems moves.
I'm Jackie Quinn.
United Nations top court is hearing a case Monday that seeks an end of German military and other aid to Israel. Nicaragua claims that Berlin is facilitating acts of genocide and breaches of international law in Gaza, where Israel's offensive has left more than 33,000 Palestinians dead. Israel strongly denies its military campaign amounts to breaches of the Genocide Convention. While the case brought by Nicaragua centers on Germany, it indirectly takes aim at Israel's military campaign. This is VOA News. Drones have attacked Ukraine's largest power plant, AP correspondent Charles Ledesma.
Officials at the Russian-controlled Zaporizhzhia nuclear power plant say the site was attacked on Sunday by Ukrainian military drones, including a strike on the dome of the plant's sixth power unit. According to the plant authorities, there was no critical damage or casualties, and radiation levels at the plant were normal after the strikes. Late on Sunday, however, Russia's state-owned nuclear agency said that three people had been wounded in the drone attack. The International Atomic Energy Agency says its experts had been informed of the drone strike and that such detonation is consistent with IAEA observations. I'm Charles de Ledesma.
International leaders are condemning Ecuador after police in the capital broke into the Mexican embassy to arrest a former vice president who had been granted political asylum. VOA's Joe Ramsey with more.
The raid on Friday prompted Mexico's president to break off diplomatic relations with Ecuador. Diplomatic premises are considered foreign soil and untouchable under international treaties. Host country law enforcement agencies are not allowed to enter without the permission of the ambassador. Police broke through the external doors of the embassy to arrest the Ecuadorian former vice president who had been living there since December. He had sought asylum after being indicted on corruption charges and it had been granted hours earlier. Joe Ramsey, VOA News.
Philippines President Ferdinand Marcos Jr. Monday called on China to talk to prevent more incidents like ramming vessels and the use of water cannon in the South China Sea. Philippines continues to talk with China, and it's exhausting all options to speak to Chinese leadership not to heat up tensions in that waterway. Rwandan President Paul Kagame has blamed the inaction of international community for allowing the 1994 genocide to happen as Rwanda commemorated 30 years since an estimated 800,000 people were killed by government-backed extremists. Rwanda has shown strong recovery and economic growth in a year since, but scars remain and there are questions about whether genuine reconciliation has been achieved under the long rule of Kagame, whose rebel movement stopped the genocide and seized power. A crusading Brazilian Supreme Court justice is adding Elon Musk to an investigation over the dissemination of fake news and investigating him separately for alleging obstruction. Justice Alexander de Moraes noted that Musk began a disinformation campaign regarding the top court's actions, including saying the social media platform X would cease to comply with the court's orders to block certain accounts. I'm Tommy McNeil, VOA News.
6 months since the Hamas attack on Israel.
This is still happening, and we're still hoping that the solution will be like any minute.
Marking the 30th anniversary of the Rwandan genocide.
Your solidarity in this moment of commemoration honors the memory of those we lost 30 years ago.
And she chases total solar eclipses. Going to tell you about a 63-year-old woman who has seen 20 of them.
I'm addicted to that feeling of that being that little few seconds or minutes, being one with the universe and being really present and feeling it.
Today is Monday, April 8th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Scott Walterman. Sunday, April 7th, marked 6 months since the Hamas attack on Israel that started the current military operation in Gaza. Israeli troops pulled out of the Al-Shifa area on Sunday to prepare for future operations, including the southern city of Rafah. Here's Defense Minister Yoav Gallant. He said the forces are exiting and preparing for their next missions. New ceasefire talks in Egypt, but Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu says that Israel will not agree to a ceasefire after 6 months of war until the hostages still being held in Gaza are released.
Israel is not the one preventing a deal. Hamas prevents a deal. Its extreme demands were intended to bring about an end to the war and leave it intact to ensure its survival, its rehabilitation, its ability to endanger our citizens and our soldiers.
The news service Reuters is reporting that both Israel and Hamas have confirmed they have delegations in Egypt for the ceasefire talks. There were demonstrations for getting the hostages released in New York, in Washington, and in Israel.
We're here today because we want everybody to be aware that this is still happening, and we're still hoping that the solution would be like any minute.
It's above politics, it's above religion, it's a humanitarian issue, and that's what we're here to shout today.
No politics, no, you know, just hearts, just being together, because those people could have been my people, your people, the government people. It doesn't matter. We are one state, one soul.
So let's go deeper into this. While we are marking the six-month point of the current conflict, it's really much older than that. Joining us to talk about this is Lori Brand, Professor Emerita of Political Science and International Relations and Middle East Studies at the University of Southern California. So here we are 6 months at the six-month anniversary of this current conflict, but really it's misleading to say that this conflict is 6 months old. It's really hundreds of years old, if you, depending on how you interpret it.
Yeah, I guess I would differ with you on that. I mean, I see this as a modern conflict in the sense that it is, I think if one wants to look at the beginnings of the emergence of nationalism and Zionism, which comes as part of that, then I think we can go back to, you know, the end of the 19th century. And then it becomes a much more sort of concrete conflict between two peoples once World War I is over and the British provide for in the mandatory instrument that came to govern Gaza, or Palestine, of which Gaza, of course, is a part, the provision for the establishment of a Jewish national home. So that then sets in motion the forces that, and also provides the environment, the possible political environment for the introduction of settlers from outside of Palestine, outside of historic Palestine, into Palestine, to begin to work toward the establishment of this Zionist national project, which ultimately became the State of Israel.
Sure. Let's explain Zionism and Arab nationalism briefly, just to set that up.
Sure. Well, Zionism is in general a, you know, a longing for Zion, which would be, historical land of Israel. But for centuries, for Jews, it was a religious longing. And there were examples of religious Jews who would leave from wherever they happened to be and then perhaps go to Palestine. Or the land of Israel as they saw it for their last days. But the idea of the development of Zionism into a political movement and one with a target of establishing a state for the Jewish people, that evolves in the late 19th century as part of a broader movement. Then Arab nationalism emerges in the, again, around the same period, largely in reaction to the end of the latter days of the Ottoman Empire, after the end of the First World War, as part of the First World War settlement, and you had the imposition then of British and French rule in different parts of the Arab East. Then you were basically establishing colonial regimes over these people as the successor regimes to the Ottoman Empire, and that then further built on and gave greater impetus to the emergence of movements seeking to get rid of these colonial presence and allow for the establishment of independent Arab-run governments.
It's complicated, right?
Very.
Yeah. It brings us to today. I mean, a lot happens, you know, mass migration, Jewish migration leading up to World War II and then after World War II into what is now Israel. And then in 48, they pushed them into Gaza and the West Bank and so forth. So the resolution isn't a ceasefire and humanitarian aid, which is the way it's sort of been framed in the last couple of weeks. This whole thing goes away with a ceasefire and humanitarian aid. But it does not.
No, not at all. Not at all. And in fact, obviously there are a number of critical issues involved in discussing, one, what happened in 1948 and how that came to an end, which, as you rightly said, was not in a political solution, but was simply a ceasefire, which then meant that there was an official state of war between the newly established state of Israel and the surrounding states. And that officially didn't begin to come to an end until Egypt signed its peace treaty with Israel in 1979. But in the meantime, of course, the very emergence of the State of Israel, which was, according to UN resolutions, supposed to witness also a parallel emergence of an Arab or Palestinian state in mandatory Palestine, the Palestinian state did not emerge. UN resolutions which were passed subsequently, which were to allow for the return of Palestinians who had been driven from their homes or fled from their homes as a result of the proximity of violence, those UN resolutions have remained in abeyance. They're still there. They're considered to be part of international law, but they've not been fulfilled.
And the two-state solution, is that anywhere on the horizon?
I don't think so.
USC Professor Lori Brand, we will continue this conversation and talk about the two-state solution and the physical condition of Gaza and the Palestinian people.
We're looking at a level of destruction across all sectors, which is well beyond anything that, the word humanitarian crisis could even begin to express.
Catch this second part of the conversation with Professor Brand on Tuesday's show, if you can, on VOA's International Edition. We're following these other stories from around the world. An engine cover on a Southwest Airlines Boeing 737-800 fell off on Sunday during takeoff in the U.S. city of Denver. It hit the wing flap, and now the U.S. Federal Aviation Administration is opening an investigation. More than 90 people died when an overcrowded makeshift ferry sank off the north coast of Mozambique. The local authorities said many children were among the victims. Poland's governing pro-European coalition came out on top in local elections Sunday, according to exit polling. It is seen as a first test since the group's landmark win in a general election last year. In the latest report on the U.S. 2024 elections, decisions by the state of Florida's high court this week open the way for tighter restrictions on abortion and the ability of Florida voters to decide this November whether or not to undo those restrictions. Reproductive rights are an important issue in this year's presidential election. Here's VOA correspondent Scott Stern.
Florida's Supreme Court this week opened the way for a ban on abortions after 6 weeks to take effect in May. But it also put abortion on the November ballot in Florida, allowing voters to decide whether to include broad abortion rights in the state constitution. That makes reproductive rights even more of an election issue in Florida and in this year's presidential race. Nearly 50 years of federal protections for abortions were overturned in 2022 by the U.S. Supreme Court, of which three justices were appointed by former President Donald Trump. Ending the protections given in a case called Roe v. Wade is something the presumptive Republican nominee has campaigned on.
I got it done. I get a kick out of these candidates and even the other side. Well, I don't know. I think I'm more pro-life. I'm this. And somebody stood up, a woman stood up and said, this guy ended Roe v. Wade. How the hell can you go against him? And I sort of said that myself, actually. But I'm proud to be the most pro-life president in American history.
But since that high court decision 2 years ago, abortion has been a losing political issue for Republicans in referendums in Ohio and Kansas. Reproductive rights are a centerpiece of President Joe Biden's reelection campaign.
Trump proudly says, quote, after 50 years with no one coming close, I was able to kill Roe v. Wade. That's a statement. You've seen it on television. Well, he's talking about how Donald Trump killed Roe v. Wade. He says it has to be punishment for women exercising their reproductive freedom. Trump and MAGA Republicans are responsible for the chaos that followed, and they're now calling for a national ban on choice for every state, in every state, not just what is in law now.
In this campaign, Trump has not endorsed a national abortion ban. He was asked this week about the Florida decision.
Mr. President, do you support the 6-week abortion ban that the Florida Supreme Court just upheld?
The issue of reproductive rights in this presidential election will also be fueled by a coming Supreme Court decision on whether to tighten restrictions on access to the drug most used to start medication abortions. Scott Stearns, VOA News.
U.S. Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen on Sunday met with Beijing Mayor Yin Yang and Premier Li Qiang.
Well, we have more to do. I believe that over the past year, we've put our bilateral relationship on a more stable footing. This is not meant ignoring our differences or avoiding tough conversations. It has meant understanding that we can only make progress if we directly and openly communicate with one another.
During the meeting with Li, Yellen said the ability to have difficult conversations has put the two economic superpowers on a more stable footing over the past year. International Edition continues. I'm Scott Walterman. Rwanda's president on Sunday led commemorations to mark 30 years since the 1994 genocide that killed more than a million people, saying the conditions that led to the slaughter would never be allowed to exist again in his country's politics.
Our journey has been long and tough. Rwanda was completely humbled by the magnitude of our loss. And the lessons we learned are engraved in blood. But the tremendous progress of our country is plain to see, and it is a result of the choices we made together to resurrect our nation.
Rwandan President Paul Kagame on Sunday lit a flame of remembrance in the capital, Kigali, to mark 30 years since the genocide that took the lives of nearly a million people. The flame of remembrance will burn for the next 100 days, the number of days that the genocide lasted in 1994. Kagame was joined by several past and current global leaders, including former U.S. President Bill Clinton and Israeli President Isaac Herzog, in laying wreaths in honor of the victims of the mass killings. In remarks, President Kagame thanked the survivors of the genocide for their efforts toward national unity.
We asked you to do the impossible by carrying the burden of reconciliation on your shoulders, and you continue to do the impossible for our nation every single day, and we thank you.
During the 100-day period in 1994, Rwanda's Hutu majority killed more than 800,000 Tutsis and Hutu moderates. The genocide in Rwanda was sparked by hate speech, mostly over the radio, by Hutu extremists against Tutsis. African Union Commission Chairperson Moussa Faki Mahamat also commended the survivors and Rwanda's approach towards justice and reconciliation, encouraging Rwandans to look forward together in unity.
Visitons Anemu.
Let's use this opportunity to revisit the journey that you have walked. I am talking about the reconciliation of hearts and spirits and consciences.
Kagame used the opportunity to caution against the increasing involvement of some African countries in tribal politics and potential resurgence of ethnic cleansing.
Rwanda's tragedy is a warning. The process of division and extremism, which leads to genocide, can happen anywhere if left unchecked.
Rwandans will remember their lost families, marking the period with wreath laying, vigils, and peace walks. Sana Nutod, VOA, Kigali, Rwanda.
La Embajada de México en Ecuador permanecerá cerrada indefinidamente.
Mexican Foreign Minister Alicia Bárcena saying, the Mexican embassy in Ecuador remains closed indefinitely. Embassy staff in Quito returned to Mexico Sunday after the Friday raid by Ecuadorian police took the diplomatic staff by surprise. Embassies are considered internationally to be the country's territory, and having a host nation raid one is unheard of. Mexico suspended bilateral relations with Ecuador after authorities in Quito seized former Ecuadorian Vice President Jorge Glass from the Mexican embassy. Glass, convicted twice for corruption, had been holed up in the embassy seeking political asylum since December. And finally, I've heard of people who follow rock bands. I have friends that traveled around the world for Grateful Dead concerts. I have one friend who's traveled to more than 50 Bruce Springsteen shows. But we found a 63-year-old woman who travels to total solar eclipses. And she's seen 20 of them and hoping that Monday she can reach 21. Here's Reuters correspondent Trevor Carroll with her story.
Letitia Farrer is an umbrophile, literally a shadow lover, but what it really means is that she's a chaser of eclipses. The 63-year-old has traveled to all seven continents and even the oceans between them in pursuit of solar eclipses. She hasn't missed one since 1998, and the eclipse over North America on April 8th will mean she's seen 21 of them.
I'm addicted to that feeling of that being that, for those few seconds or minutes, being one with the universe and being really present and feeling it. And then, of course, there's always the planning for the next one. My life is measured in eclipses. So my first one in North America was the 1991. My second one in North America was the 2017, and this will be my third. But I've been to Europe for one of them. I've now gone to Africa twice. I've gone to Australia 3 times. I've gone to Antarctica 2 times. I've gone to Asia 3 times. I think that counts for Indonesia. And a couple of oceans. There were a couple of them that we were in the middle of the Atlantic or the middle of the Pacific. It wasn't on land anywhere.
Favor budgets for travel and takes vacation from her day job to witness the events. She also hosts an Eclipse podcast called Totality Talks, interviewing experts and enthusiasts. But her obsession has had its challenges. In 2017, Favor was diagnosed with an ovarian cancer, but she delayed treatment to make it to see an eclipse that year. And there was another in 2010, the year her first husband died.
So he died in June. There was a total solar eclipse in South America that I hadn't even booked for because we were dealing with his health issues. And he passed, and I just said, you know what? I watched his dreams die with him, and I'm not going to let my dreams die.
A year later, Farah met her current husband, Daniel Brookshire, on the dating website eHarmony. Her profile made it clear that she had a mission to see every total solar eclipse.
I didn't even understand it until we started doing it. And it's a lot of effort to try to see an eclipse, and I just had no idea. I think this is going to be the first eclipse that we didn't have to take 2 airplanes at least to get to, or in a long ride and 2 buses and whatever to get to.
The Dallas area where they live is within the eclipse's path of totality. To raise awareness of the celestial event, Farah has been traveling across Texas, speaking to schools and community organizations.
That's my goal, is to get more people interested in it so they don't miss this wonderful opportunity.
Farah says she hopes to make it to age 103 and bring her eclipse count up to 50.
Reuters correspondent Trevor Carroll. This has been International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of everyone here at VOA, thank you so much for spending this time with us. For pictures, stories, videos, and more, follow VOA News on your favorite social media platform and online at voanews.com. In Washington, I'm Scott Walter.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
75 years ago, the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, or NATO, with 12 founding members, was established to preserve transatlantic peace. Over the past 7 decades, NATO helped prevent the Iron Curtain from enveloping the free nations of Western Europe, helped avert war with the Soviet Union, and helped newly independent nations walk the path to democracy, said Secretary of State Antony Blinken at an event in Brussels marking NATO's 75th anniversary.
We are indebted to the millions of soldiers, sailors, aviators, whose courage and willingness to put their lives on the line have given weight to our sacred commitment to defend one another.
Over the years, new challenges have emerged that the founders of NATO could not possibly have foreseen. But the alliance is meeting those threats by adapting together, said Secretary Blinken.
Over the past 3 years, we've enhanced our deterrence. We've reinforced our eastern flank. We've ramped up investments in our defense industrial capacity. We've launched a new strategic concept. We've welcomed 2 exceptionally capable new members. All work that our leaders will carry forward at the Washington Summit in July.
Secretary Blinken reiterated that NATO is a defensive alliance. It's never had and it never will have designs on the territory of another country.
As Truman said at the founding, the purpose of this defensive alliance is to allow us to get on with the real business of life, the real business of government, the real business of society, achieving a fuller and happier life for all our citizens. In that way, the true measure of NATO's success is not merely the enemies that it's deterred or the territory it's defended, but all the ways our citizens have used their security, used their freedom to improve their lives in tangible ways.
No wonder that democracies continue to make great sacrifices to join this alliance, said Secretary Blinken. So as we celebrate this extraordinary alliance, let's recommit ourselves to shoring up the foundations of peace, as well as anticipating new and emerging threats. Finally, said Secretary Blinken, let us together protect all we've built in 75 years under NATO's shield and ensure that it remains strong to keep building for the next 75 years and well beyond that.
That was an editorial reflecting the view.